It's time for Listen Up, a series of conversations with children's book authors and illustrators, educators and literacy experts. Brandon Mull's daydreams about fantastical beings in the woods outside of his boyhood home, fueled by a lifetime of reading speculative fiction, sparked the New York Times best-selling Fablehaven series. Listen up as we talk to Brandon about the challenges of creating an entirely new world for his Beyonders trilogy, as well as his tireless passion for encouraging kids to read.
Let's just start at the beginning then. How did you come up with the idea of secret refuges for magic creatures for Fablehaven?
I used to live in Connecticut, and when I lived in Connecticut, my house was surrounded by trees, and I would daydream what if there was weird monsters or creatures out in the woods, which led me to think what would be an excuse for magical creatures to live in our world. And so the excuse I came up with was, okay, what if they're on these organized wildlife parks, organized wildlife refuges? That idea became kind of like a playground in my head. I started asking myself what kind of creatures would live there, who'd want to help them, who'd want to harm them, who'd be interesting characters to discover them. And over time, it grew into a story that I was excited to tell.
Like the Harry Potter books, the Fablehaven series, even though it's written for middle grade readers, it's been really successful across audiences, boys and girls, middle grade, adults, young adults, all have enjoyed it. What's the secret to writing a book that's appropriate for young readers but also appeals to a broader audience?
You know, and it's funny that you would mention Harry Potter, because Harry Potter was the series that kind of inspired me to try to write in this category. When I read Harry Potter, I read it in college. The first three were out, I think, at the time, and I really enjoyed it. It really fit my imagination, it was my kind of crazy, basically. And my mom liked it too, so did little kids. And so I was like, wow, what's the secret here? And as I thought it through, I think it's you write young main characters, which keeps it accessible for kids, but then you write the books as smart as you can and make the adventure as cool as you can. I basically found proof in Harry Potter that if you write a fantasy adventure with young main characters, but make the adventure big and cool and smart, a reader will go on that. An adult reader will go on that ride and have a good time. Myself, I mean, I'm a 36-year-old guy, and I don't know how to write a book that I don't like. I don't know how I would do that. And so I try to write a book that I would enjoy, but stay true to what my inner 10-year-old would enjoy as well. Keep the main characters young and stay true to that. And that kind of takes care of the point of view, because you're in the head of a 12-year-old, and so it's not going to feel too adultish if you're true to that point of view. But then I write the adults like adults, as their conversations and the things the kids see. I mean, I write it how I would write it in an adult novel, and that seems to work out.
Certainly seems it has for that series.
It's been a huge relief. If I was to give you my mission statement, I'm trying to write books that a whole family could read and nobody would be bored. The kind of thing that if you popped in as an audiobook on a family trip, dad's not bored, mom's not bored, the kids are having a good time. Like that's my goal, is to write a book a whole family could read together and then discuss. And I was aware enough of that, we even put a reading guide in the back of all the Fablehaven books for like discussion group kind of things, because we were like, we wanted, whether it's in a classroom or whether it's with a family, there was some obvious themes, I think, in the books and the little reading guide in the back. Hopefully parents and kids read it together and they have something to talk about afterwards. I mean, even though we're writing fantasy, a lot of times fantasy is a great way to look at real world issues from a safe distance.
And that actually was my next question, was that you have on your website a whole section of resources for teachers who want to use the Fablehaven books in your classrooms. So I wanted to talk a little bit about them, and have you had feedback and just talk to other teachers? And
teachers seem to really like the resources on brandonmull.com. That's right. My main website, myname.com, BrandonMull. And brandonmull.com has video stuff, like video clips where I talk about writing. It has a really terrific video trailer for the Beyonders series, which I call it terrific because it's my one trailer where when I've shown it to kids, it seems like it really works, like it gets kids into it.
It's like a movie.
It's well produced, yeah. It's way better produced than it should be, basically. It's a beautifully produced trailer. It does. It almost looks like a movie. And so it's a great way to get those reluctant reader boys, especially, I think, see that and go, oh, it kind of paints the picture for them and gives them a head start on getting interested. And so there's resources like that online. And then also in the back of the Fablehaven books, in the back of my book, The Candy Shop War, there's reading guides just built into every book. And the reading guides just give you some discussion questions that could start conversations. So, it just does a little bit of the thinking for you on some of the themes you could pull out of the book. Beyonders, I think I've kind of alluded to this already, but it's a good story to explore the concept of heroism. One thing I do when I come into schools is I will just pose a few questions to the kids. First, I'll see who are their heroes, right? And sometimes it's family members, sometimes it's sports heroes, sometimes it's political heroes. You know, there's a wide variety, you know, from Martin Luther King to Kobe Bryant to whatever, you know what I mean? Like there's a wide variety of heroes, you know, to George Washington, to fictional heroes, to comic book heroes, Superman and stuff. So they give me some heroes. I talk to them about some of my heroes to fill in some of the gaps, you know, in the kinds of heroes that they describe. And then we go into what makes somebody a hero. You know, I pose that question. And it's amazing how when you get to the what makes somebody a hero question, they tend to, at least in my experience, the kids tend to gravitate towards pretty good answers, like, you know, things like that they have integrity or that they have courage or that they try to do what's right or that they help other people. And then you bring that together and, you know, discuss what makes someone a hero. And then the way you can tie this into the book is in the book we have this variety of heroes. We have a couple kids trying to become heroes. Forced into a situation where they either need to try to become heroes or run and hide. And we have a lot of characters who used to be heroes who have fallen for different reasons. So it's a great opportunity to talk about why heroes fall or how they can be redeemed or how we can, you know, fix ourselves if we feel like we've fallen. There's a real world situation where we have, I think, a lot of traditional American heroes, which if you describe traditional American heroes as being politicians, sports figures, and movie stars, there's a lot of traditional American heroes that sort of let us down sometimes, you know, and you know, we see fallen heroes, and I don't want to name names, but in a classroom you probably could, or let the kids name some names of people where, oh, that's too bad that guy did that or that that woman did that. And the idea of, you know, I think our world has grown a little bit cynical about some of our traditional heroes and maybe a little cynical about the concept of heroism. And in Beyonders, we're looking at how do you be a hero in a world that's grown cynical about heroes? And I think that that's a real world concept that we can talk about from a safe distance in a fantasy environment, but that's useful for discussion. So,
that's great. I have to ask you, since you have so much interest in teacher resources, did you ever think about being a teacher?
Oh, yeah. Teaching was on my short list. Yeah. I went and interviewed to be an English teacher on the Navajo reservations in southern Utah. I mean, it almost happened, and then the job that happened to come along was a marketing job. But yeah. But it was totally on my short list. I love that I get to scratch that itch. I go into lots of schools. I've done about 850 school visits in 35 states in the last 5 years.
Wow.
And that's more than the average author, but it's partly because I enjoy it a lot. I like to connect with kids, and no matter how well or poorly the books do over time, I expect to keep school visits as part of what I do, because to me it's a fun way to connect with my readership, and it's a fun way to feel like the job's doing some good. If I can get reluctant readers reading, I have a lot of success with that. For read-aloud type stuff, because Beyonders is so complicated, for read-aloud stuff, I would recommend more Fable Haven 1 or Candy Shop, where I get a lot of feedback that those books have turned reluctant readers into eager readers. For me, fantasy was my gateway to literacy.
Me too.
through Narnia and through, you know, some books like that, The Big Imagination, it really responded to me. I really responded to it, and it could compete with TV, and it could compete with movies, because the movie in my head on these fantasy books was so cool. And so I'm trying to write that kind of book. I mean, I'm trying to write the kind of book that'll take kids on a fun ride, that have some substance to it, but that at the end of the day, hopefully when they read it, they'll go read the second one, or they'll go read, you know, it'll create a reading habit. And I get lots of letters and emails about flipping reluctant readers to eager readers. That's probably the best doing some good part of my job that I have, is just getting kids reading for fun, creating the habit.
Often you give advice to young readers when you speak. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I go into schools. I present usually for about 40 minutes, and I talk about why we read for fun and why we create. Kind of the theme of my presentation is how imagination can take you places, and I believe it can take you places both in your mind, you know, like to fantasy worlds or to the past or to the future. Also, your imagination can take you places in life as you use it and share it. You know, I've gone around the world now sharing messages with kids, and it's just because I shared my imagination with my books. Advice for young readers would include reading a lot, writing a lot, getting feedback from smart people. At the end of the day, if you get a master's in creative writing, that's essentially what you do. You read a lot, you write a lot, you get feedback from smart people. And I tell young readers that the guts of a good story is interesting characters facing interesting trouble. If you understand who your characters are, and if you understand their relationships, then that's what's going to bring life into the story. And then if you give them interesting trouble or problems to deal with, you know, whether, you know, and hopefully a nice mix of trouble, some internal, some, you know, it could be from saving a life to, you know, they didn't get their homework done. You know, there's all these different kinds of trouble. But as they face trouble, that's what makes the story interesting. And so I tell kids to think through who their characters are. If they understand their characters, then they can if they understand who they are, then they can understand how they'll react in different situations. They can understand what they would say in a conversation, if this person is brave or if this person is shy or if this person is bold or selfish or whatever. The better they understand their characters, the more they can bring them to life in an authentic way and make them consistent, which helps create the illusion that they're real. As they understand the trouble the characters are facing, they understand the shape of their book, right? So once I tell kids, once you've worked through the trouble, your story's over. And if lots of trouble is a big story, and a little bit of trouble and fewer characters, that's a shorter story.
Let's start to talk about your new book, Beyonders, A World Without Heroes. This time, instead of having magic in the everyday world, you transport the young heroes into a dangerous, magical world that's oppressed by a wizard. Tell us about the new story and the quest for a pretty unique weapon that can destroy the evil wizard.
Okay, so with Beyonders, you know, one of my goals as a writer is to try to get better at what I do, and I don't want to write the same story over and over again. So Beyonders has a very different feel from Fablehaven, and you highlighted part of that. Fablehaven, we've got characters going to secret wildlife parks for magical creatures hidden in our world. And to populate those wildlife parks, I use lots of creatures from our own myths and traditions. So you'll see stuff, usually stuff that's familiar there, centaurs or satyrs or dragons or fairies, or, you know, things from different traditions, a variety of traditions, but as if our myths and legends come to life in these places, right? With Beyonders, I wanted it to feel like we'd crossed over to another world, like a Narnia-type story where we leave our reality and go to another reality. So our main characters are from our world, which helps keep them relatable, but... I wanted to create a world that was different, populated by things that were different than what we've seen before. I didn't want to use elves and dwarves and stuff that was really familiar, so I tried to create some of my own magical races. An example of a race I created is a race of people called the Amar Cabal. The Amar Cabal are the people of the seed. These guys have seeds at the base of their skull, so if they get killed, the seed pops out, and the seed preserves their memories. So if you plant the seed, they can regrow and live again, kind of in their young adult form. If their seed doesn't get destroyed, these guys can live over and over. That's an example of one race that, to me, I hadn't seen before, but that had a lot of fun story possibilities, because here we have these heroes who could be killed and be reborn. Our central problem we have when we cross over into Lyrian, which is the world in Beyonders, is we have an emperor who is systematically trying to get rid of all the heroes. He's not trying to kill the heroes, because if he kills them, that might make them more famous. He's, you know, turn them into martyrs or something. He's trying to break the heroes. He wants to buy them off, turn them into sellouts, leave them looking and feeling like failures. Essentially, he's waging war against the idea of being a hero. He's trying to just kill the idea. He figures if he can do that, then he totally wins. You know, there's no one left to oppose him. So that made the cast of characters in Beyonders really fun. We've got all these broken heroes who are trying to pull themselves back together and stand up to this guy. And the kids who crossed over into Lyrian are trying to learn how to be heroes. So, I mean, there's a definite heroism kind of theme in Beyonders as we look at broken heroes trying to redeem themselves, and as we look at why heroes fall, and as we look at what it takes to be a hero and become a hero. I think fantasy's always done a great job at looking at heroes, but I thought this was kind of a different angle to attack the idea from. You know, this emperor who's just waging war on the concept.
I like the idea of what you have as the weapon.
Oh yeah, that's right, the weapon. Yeah. With all the rambling, I missed that. Yeah, in this world, especially in book one, the emphasis is on there is a six-syllable word that has the power to unmake this emperor, that has the power to destroy him. It's a consequence that he was once the apprentice to this evil wizard who created almost like a word that that was like a safeguard in case this emperor ever tried to betray his master. There's this word that's like woven into his makeup where if it's spoken, he's just unmade instantly, right? So the characters in our story are trying to find a word that can, you know, and it's been broken up so the syllables are hidden throughout, and that leads to some quest type adventure where they're, you know, they have to get past a variety of obstacles to obtain some of these syllables. And that one of the central problems, maybe the central problem in book one, is kind of the quest to try to find this word.
And plus it emphasizes sort of the power of words.
The power of words is totally throughout this one, because the system of magic I created for this world is that it's kind of like the language that was used to create this world is how magic sort of works in this world. It's like, and this word is part of that, you know what I mean? And so it's like, basically it's not magic like, you know, wave your magic wand. It's magic like, the magic is the language. It's
right.
A language called Edomic. And if you can learn these Edomic words and if you can speak them with authority, then you can cause things to happen or change, you know, warp reality or, you know, in different ways.
So Beyonders certainly leaves people looking for a sequel. Is there more to come?
Yes, Beyonders is a three-book series. And actually, I've been planning this series for about 10 years. It's probably, I can't imagine I will ever write a series that I plan longer or harder, because it's just been so much time, the quantity of time. I've put into this one. I've done, you know, a lot of drafts, a lot of exploratory writing as I was coming up with it. And I think that will show. Like, one of the consequences of that is I knew I had a sequel coming, you know what I mean? So this is definitely even less than Fablehaven. It's the first book. I mean, it deals with a central problem that gets solved, but it's definitely not complete in itself. It's part of a three-book thing. It will definitely be a three-book series. Book one is called A World Without Heroes. Book two will be called Seeds of Rebellion. Book three will be called Chasing the Prophecy, probably. And I'm very proud of the book. Like as far as who it's for, my Fablehaven books, book one is... book one's closer to being the kind of book where a kid's getting used to a thick book and you can give them that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Whereas as the Fablehaven series goes on, each of the books gets a little thicker and more complicated. Until by the time you get to book four or five, it's you know, I'd put it around the realm of Harry Potter 4.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like not quite
same
to 7.
Thing happened
but,
there.
But, yeah. But yeah, more like it's, you know, it starts off around the neighborhood of Fablehaven 1. I mean, of Harry Potter 1. And then by the end of Fablehaven, we're around the realm of Harry Potter 4. And so... Beyonders starts out kind of like the last Fablehaven book. Beyonders is not the first thick book you give a kid. Beyonders is a kid is getting confident with a thick book. Then Beyonders is for them.
Well, they read the Fablehaven series and then they start on the Beyonders.
It's kind of set up that way. It's set up. It's perfect if they've read the Fablehaven. Right. Beyonders isn't connected to Fablehaven.
No.
In terms of
maturity.
But
as
far as reading ability, it's about right. If they can read all the Fablehavens, or you know, the same kind of kid that can read the Percys or the Harry Potters or that kind of stuff. That kind of kid should have a great time with Beyonders. One of the consequences of this is that I think Beyonders will be read by teens and adults even more than Fablehaven.
Right.
And I think it's very, very... there's a lot of story there. It's right on the upper side of the middle grade category.
Right.
And so what adults will find there is a read probably that will be surprisingly satisfying, especially the three together. Like, the setups and payoffs I have worked out will be really... I mean, unless my judgment is shot, it'll be really...
Not based on the first one.
it'll take them on a really good ride, I think, yeah.
When is the next one coming out? When can our
the next Beyonders? Sometime next spring. So we're talking spring of 2012. For sure, it'll be a book a year. For sure, it'll be like next spring and then the spring after that for two and three. Like that's I've never missed a deadline. So
I have to ask you how that really cool holographic cover came.
Okay, there is a cool holographic cover, and the holographic cover is actually mostly available at Barnes and Noble. I think.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah. So it was a special promotion that the publisher did with them. A happy thing was that Barnes & Noble was really excited about the book and wanted to do a special promotion. But as an author, when I saw the holographic cover, I was totally geeked out.
Oh, I know. Really me too. I was like, wow.
It looks really cool. Like, it looks just, yeah, it looks a little better than average. And I mean, I love the cover on any of the books. And of course, the content's the same. But yeah, I think they call it lenticular or something. I'm not sure exactly what the technology is. But whatever the technology is, it does. It gives it a really neat 3D effect.
Right. And of course, really attracts your eye.
Yeah. We've kind of got this grasping, mysterious guy on the cover, and so like it makes it kind of pop out at you a little bit.
I just wanted to bounce back a little bit to Pingo.
Yeah.
Your first book for younger kids. What made you decide to do a picture book?
There was a few factors that made me want to do Pingo. Pingo is the story of a boy whose imaginary friend becomes his imaginary enemy when he tries to stop believing in him, and. Probably the principal reason I wrote it is because at that point in my career, my own kids were very young. My oldest is still only 7, and I've got 4 kids. And so I wanted to write something I could share with my little guys. I mean, one of my best moments as an author was sharing Pingo with my daughter's first grade class. That was just, hands down, one of my best days of being an author. And so so part of it was that. Part of it was so I'd have something I could share with my kids, because my other books, you know, you're getting more into fourth and fifth grade before they're jumping into it. Another reason I wrote it was because I'm a 36-year-old guy who pretends he talks to centaurs. And so, you know, I have a healthy relationship with my imagination. And so I'd always had this kind of, or at least for a long time, I'd had this tickling idea of, you know, why do we give up on our imagination when we get older? Or why do we stop having imaginary friends as we get older? You know, even as a kid, I knew my imaginary friend was imaginary. It was just fun to
have one as a kid.
Yeah, I had an imaginary friend as a kid, and I was perfectly aware that it was imaginary, but to me it was still fun. And then at some point I decided to quit doing that. And so I wanted to write a story about, you know, why do we break up with our imaginary friends? Why does that have to happen? And sort of in Pingo, he feels like he's getting too old to have an imaginary friend, so he breaks up with the imaginary friend, but the imaginary friend refuses to go away, becomes his imaginary enemy, and in the end they end up having to reconcile, you know, which I thought was just sort of a silly, fun way to attack that idea.
Listen Up is brought to you by the International Reading Association and is exclusive to IRA's Teacher to Teacher membership community on Engage.